Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey folks, Zach Osman here, Indianapolis Star. He's Mike Nislik, Bloomington Herald Times. Happy New Year. Sorry we haven't done one of these in a while. We both were kind of burning through some time off around Christmas. Obviously, things got a little quiet there after a flurry sort of pre-holiday between some basketball games and also obviously Kurt Cignetti's recruiting really kind of going into overdrive. And guess what? New year, same story. Indiana is back in Big Ten play, not necessarily for the better at the moment. But Kurt Cignetti is continuing his rather impressive momentum in rebuilding Indiana's roster, retooling Indiana's roster. We'll talk a little bit about all of it, I think, here in the next 30, 35 minutes. First of all, Mr. Nislik, how was Lincoln? Did you enjoy yourself?
Their basketball facility was quite impressive. And the exterior of the football was impressive as well. I've never been there to Lincoln. It felt like almost like a NBA arena. That's how impressive. Mm-hmm. I mean, freestanding, very large, broomy, comfortable.
Think about the fact that they fill that place up for volleyball all the time.
I mean, it must make for a pretty impressive atmosphere. I mean, it was a good crowd for an 8 o'clock game with bad weather, you know, for the men's game too. But yeah, I was really impressed with their facilities. Just, you know, really impressed.
Indiana obviously did not enjoy the trip quite so much. Hoosiers lose 86-70 to Nebraska in a game that, I mean, it's fair to say it probably exposed a number of this team's shortcomings for me, and you're welcome to disagree, obviously. The biggest one is just defense. I think, you know, Mike Woodson's kind of talked about a handful of things. He's talked about rebounding the ball. He's talked about turnovers, and he's talked about defense kind of coming out of that game. You know, for whatever reason, and I think there are a few of them, Indiana's never been like a prolific rebounding team under Mike Woodson. And I've always sort of felt like turnovers are kind of a symptom of something else going on with your team, frankly. Right now, this team, I mean, just like the defense that's got to give this team like a ground to stand on just isn't there. And I think that's leading to a lot of other stuff, rushed possessions, bad decisions, trying too hard to play on the break because you're so worried about, you know, games turning into these really back and forth affairs that you can't manage, rush shots, which in effect, you know, act like turnovers. Indiana's got to find a way to get better defensively.
Yeah, that's interesting about the turnovers, you know, because obviously that's what Mike kind of Woodson kind of focused on. And, you know, you kind of the last two games, you know, it's just been kind of a disaster in that way, but you are right. Defensively, you know, they just sort of fell apart. It's hard to say, you know, like what's the issue. I mean, they just didn't play very, you know, to me, I don't want to question effort, but it just didn't seem like they were all that focused for that game. And one thing, you know, we talked about, you know, they were had been battle tested this season, but once they kind of got hit in the mouth, they just sort of folded, which kind of surprised me. You know, Khalil Ware was back in the lineup. You know, was he 100%? And Xavier Johnson, obviously, you know, Mike Woodson didn't mince any words. Called his 14 minutes awful, an awful 14 minutes. So we should try to do better. We should not try to do an awful 30-minute podcast. Just all sorts of issues last night. I mean, and defensively, certainly ranks up there.
Woodson said something, and I mean, you know, he has a talent for sometimes just being very direct without being blunt or dismissive. He just said, we're not as good as we were defensively in my first 2 years. And if you look at it, I mean, you know, adjusted offensive or adjusted defensive efficiency, 24 his first year nationally, 45 his second year. Last year, opponents were they were 42nd in opponent effective field goal percentage. The year before that, 27th. Again, they've never been a great offensive rebounding team, or I should say, excuse me, they've never been a great rebounding team in terms of opponent offensive rebounding percentage. I think we've talked about that A lot of that comes down to the fact that opponents settle for jumpers against this team, and they did last year because Trace Jackson Davis was such a good rim protecting presence. That leads to longer caroms. This year, frankly, they're also just, I think, hunting more jumpers because, I mean, Indiana's 263rd nationally in opponent three-point percentage. The block rate has come down a little bit. But, you know, much more than that, teams are just hunting threes because they know they can. And even, you know, even rim protection's not horrible, but Indiana's barely inside the top 100 in opponent two-point percentage. And keep in mind, this is all at the, you know, this is all through three Big Ten games. These numbers don't tend to get better from your non-conference when you're playing a lot of filler, as opposed to when you get into conference play and every game's more of a challenge. A team that was 10th in Woodson's first season in two-point defense and 20th nationally last year is 98th now. So even that has regressed a little bit. I mean, it's just, you know, there's been an alarming rise in the number of opponent baskets that are assisted, which I think, again, goes back to a lot of the problems they've had defending the three and just how much ball rotation and ball screen offense has gotten them kind of really sort of scrambled and discombobulated defensively. It just feels like of all the things that are affecting Indiana, if Mike Woodson was just sort of given like one wish and he could snap his fingers and one of these things would be fixed tomorrow, the one that I think would have the greatest sort of like positive cascade effect across the rest of the team performance would be just getting back to something even approaching the level they were at defensively a year ago.
Well, and what was interesting sort of yesterday was sort of a symptom of what we talked about, that, you know, every time they've struggled, you know, when they face a team that makes their 3-point shots, this team has no chance. Like in the second half, in the first half, it was a game because Nebraska was, you know, bombing it from 3-point range, but not making them. And then in the second half, they started dropping those shots. And they had no chance. I mean, they just the game got out of hand, and I think that's going to be kind of the pattern here. Like if they go against teams that can hit their 3-point shots, this team's going to struggle, I think, against every one of them. It's just that simple.
Do you want my pet theory then, I try not to be the guy that like says, oh, the coach should do this, the player should do this, but I wrote about it today, so I'm happy to share it with you. I think they should play a lot more zone.
Just to muck up the games?
Well, a little bit that, I mean, you know, that so like the first part of the argument is basically what are the downsides of a zone? It's harder to rebound the ball because guys don't tend to crash. You know,
but they're not rebounding the ball anyway.
Right. In theory, it's easier to shoot threes over a zone. Again, they're 263rd nationally in opponent three-point percentage. They're 335th nationally in opponent three-point attempt percentage. So, like, teams are already shooting a bunch of threes and already making a bunch of threes against them anyway.
That's second worst in the country, right? There's 350. Is that worst?
No, 335th.
Oh, I thought you said
362 Division I teams. Now. Okay. But I mean, like, that's
not much room to go to the bottom.
You're still. I mean, teams are already. The point is, teams already know. Shoot a bunch of threes, make a bunch of threes. You'll beat Indiana. So what's the difference? The flip side is, it slows down transition offense. If it's done, you know, to even an adequate level, it stops a fair bit of penetration. It takes away a lot of the ball screen actions that give Indiana so much trouble. And actually, you know, I think Indiana has the personnel to play it now. Can they coach it? Can they get the feel for it? That's kind of got to come because, you know, Mike Woodson has said many times he'd never really coached a zone before. Probably a lot of these kids haven't played that much zone before. It's not something you do a ton of in high school, or in prep or in AAU. But the other part of it too, is like, there's that whole thing about like, well, good 3-point shooting teams will always beat a zone. The flip side is sometimes you throw a zone at a good 3-point shooting team and Indiana fans will have a Pavlovian response to mentioning the 2013 Sweet 16 game against Syracuse. Sometimes you throw a zone at a good 3-point shooting team and that team thinks, oh, well, then all we got to do is shoot threes tonight, and suddenly they're one-dimensional. And if a few of those don't go down, suddenly they've made themselves easier to guard. It's tough because coaches always walk this line and it's really easy for fans to just say, well, rip up everything that you spent 5 months preparing and just go do something else, right? Like it's, you know, tear up months and months of planning and roster construction and player development and just go do something else. It's not that simple. But in the same breath, it's not like Indiana's starting from zero here. I mean, Woodson clearly had the zone on his mind as an option in the preseason. Indiana's synergy's only chartered Indiana with 19 zone possessions. It feels like they've played a few more of those. Those numbers can be a little bit like a little bit just kind of like 2 years ago, Synergy chartered Indiana with one zone possession the entire year. It's like, I don't think Indiana dropped into zone like one time and then just never did it again.
One play. It would have been,
but I mean, like if you look at those 19 possessions, Indiana's at like 0.74 points per possession allowed. And man, it's like 0.92. It's an incredibly drastic difference in sample size, but the two times Indiana really committed to it were Louisville and Kennesaw State, and in both cases it changed the game. I just don't think it would hurt Indiana to explore the idea of a really sort of basic 2-3 zone as a decent option, because the flip side to everything that you could say as a knock on the zone is teams don't see it a lot, and therefore zone offenses in college don't tend to be hugely refined unless you play in a conference that has a Syracuse or a team that plays a lot of zone, so you know to prepare for it. Just don't think it would hurt to try.
Do you think, I mean, you wrote a little bit about this with Mike Woodson, and you know, to turn this team around, he has to do like his best coaching job. Do you think he has the mentality to be able to do that? Like, I mean, just to go against his sort of philosophies and his sort of tendencies. I think you tweeted about, going back to guys with two falls in the first half, kind of, you know, trying to do things that break the mold a little bit. Not, like you said, drastic, where it's like, you know, we're benching the starting quarterback after week one, but to, he's an old school coach. He has very, I would say, set in his ways. When he's now faced with a team that isn't really doing what he would like or what he wants, sort of. It doesn't look like the team I think he wants right now. Can he steer them out of it by doing something different? Do you think he's willing to do that?
I think that's the trick with like coaching in general, because like if you're a coach.
But I think new age analytical guys aren't sort of stuck to things like that. To an extent
they aren't, but like, I mean, first of all, it's part of it's going to be Woodson's confidence in his ability to coach it. Like, you know, a coach isn't
going not just speaking to like zone, that. Just anything. I'm just curious of your take about kind of, because they need something, right? Like that, like what they're sort of, and they're limited by their roster construction. I'm just curious kind of what your take on, can he do that? You know, is he capable, you know, based on his personality?
I mean, I think it's something that he's got to be able to, I don't know if the word would be explore. Like, I think he's got to try to find his way to it at least. Now, maybe it's not something as drastic as a zone, or maybe it's not, you know, I mean, maybe it's not like they just go from, you know, 1% zone to 90% zone, but it's just finding, you know, something that gets these players in just frankly a better position to succeed. Because I mean, like I don't think Indiana's going to figure out everything it's got to figure out to get substantially better between now and, you know, Valentine's Day to get this season on the course they wanted to. Now, I also say that, you know, listen, you weren't here last year, but like last year, Indiana, they started 7-0. They won at Xavier, which turned out to be a really nice win. They battered North Carolina at home. And then they lost 3 of 4, Rutgers away. They beat Nebraska at home. And then they lost bad to Arizona on a neutral floor and Kansas on the road. And then they had these two kind of get-right games around Christmas. And then they lost 3 in a row in Big Ten play. And they allowed 91 to Iowa, 84 at home to Northwestern, and 85 to Penn State. And everyone was like, I mean, they were 1-4 in the conference. Everybody was just like, this is out of control. They've lost, you know, it's all careening in a terrible direction. And then they won 9 of their next 10, you know, and they beat Illinois on the road in that time. They beat Wisconsin, Michigan State, Ohio State, and Purdue, and Rutgers all at home in that time. And then it was just like, well, never, you know, they're fine. Everything's fine. There's no, you know, the season is perfectly fine. They're on course for a comfortable tournament berth, yada, yada, yada. I just think that this, sorry, that's my outlook. I just think that there is always going to be an element of this that is sort of like, hey, you need to wait and see what happens. It's January 5th, and there are people out there who will have you believe the season is effectively over. If they win their next two games, and I'm not necessarily predicting they will, but if they win their next two games, then, you know, this conversation is suddenly dramatically reframed. They're 12-4, they're 4-1 in the conference, you know. But
the difference is, right, like that team had an identity that they didn't have to
be. That's what I think. And I tried to write this after the Nebraska game, and I don't think I did a very good job of it, but it's like, it's hard to kind of understand like where this team goes for like the, you know, like where's the Alamo for this team where they just say like, we retreat this far, but no further. And this is where you make our stand and we push back. Like, the, you know, it doesn't feel like they've got that. And that's something Woodson, to his credit, really instilled into those first two teams. And I think that's something that Indiana's got to find. And, you know, to your point about like the wider idea of coaches changing, like in any coach's defense, a coach might be fair in saying like, well, you're talking about making dramatic changes, but I'm just trying to get my guys to like buy into the most fundamental stuff that I think is going to underpin success. So if I'm making these enormous changes, then are they all going to?
Yeah, and I don't mean necessarily like sweeping changes. I just meant you got, you know, change up rotations or just, you know, do some things that you might not necessarily do, you know, if things were going well. But I mean, it's not a little of that. I mean, Anthony Leo's kind of gotten in the rotation. He's gone less to kind of the full bench at times. But I just think that that's something he needs to kind of look at to sort of, you know, I think he's going to have to go against the grain or his natural tendencies to maybe kind of get this thing right, I guess would be the way I'd frame it.
I agree with that. And again, I think that's why that is why I sort of suggested the idea that maybe they, you know, I mean, the zone has achieved what they badly needed it to achieve basically every time they've
played. I mean, it couldn't be worse than what they put in the second half on the floor, that's for sure. Against Nebraska. I mean, that's a pretty easy way to analyze that. I mean, they didn't stop anything, so.
Ohio State Saturday night, and we're recording this on the Friday, so you may be listening to it before then. I mean, it's Ohio State is one of the most efficient offenses in the country. I think they can burn hot and cold a little bit. You know, you saw that against Rutgers, where I think they were like 9 of 11 or 9 of 10 from three in the first half, and then they made one or two threes the entire second half. It's worth saying they've only been on the road once this season. They lost at Penn State, so they have some nice neutral wins. They beat UCLA, they beat Alabama, they beat Santa Clara, but their only true road game, they lost to a Penn State team that obviously isn't very good right now itself, just lost by 31 at Michigan State. I mean, I hesitate to call it a must win because, again, it's January 5th. The game will be January 6th. Like, I just think you can really sort of drive a group of people, a fan base, you know, to the brink of exhaustion if you start talking about must wins in early January.
Fans were not happy, though, about the performance.
And I don't think they should have been, but I just think this is the kind of game where, like, you've got to find your way to at least winning these kinds of games for now, your home games, games against good teams, but not.
Well, because I think if you lose this, it makes those, you know, makes your next couple games must wins almost. You know, you're putting more pressure every time you kind
of just find your way to winning some of these games for the moment while you try to fix some of this, and then see if you can't just get yourself in a position where you're ready to attack the back half of the schedule a little bit better. I do think Indiana could really, really use a result Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, and another one, Woodson casually dropped in. What did he say? I mean, I think he's just like, we just got our ass kicked. I mean, you can't do it, right? I mean, I think, like you said, you got to be better with the ball. You know, near 20 turnover effort again, and I think you're hitting the alarm, right? Like, if they just can't get that right, at least, you know, because the. Even though they beat Kennesaw State, I mean, that was an ugly win in and of itself. And I know they didn't have Ware, but, you know, they've not played particularly well the last two games.
No. And if there's something I think for Indiana to still hold on to, it's that when you've been in most of these close games, you found a way to battle through. But, you know, those, with the exception of Michigan, which, you know, on the back of last night, doesn't look like a win with much polish right now. Those were against the sorts of teams you should have been beating anyway. So we'll talk more about it next week. I think it's probably fair to say get the other side of Ohio State and Rutgers and kind of see where Indiana is. You always find yourself saying that, you know, just basically kind of take the next week's two games of a piece, see where they get you and move forward. But we shouldn't get out of here without talking about football. Kurt Cignetti has had a flurry of activity, forgive me, in the portal on, what was that, Thursday night. Elijah Green, a running back from North Carolina that, you know, statistically, I think he had one pretty fairly productive season, but nothing, you know, nothing just kind of earth-shattering. Gives Indiana some experience depth there. And then two safeties who started next to each other at Old Dominion combined for 200 tackles last season that I think it's fair to say more or less, you know, you're going to make them earn it, but you can probably pencil those two guys in at or near the top of the depth chart at a position that badly needed replenishing. And then I still haven't found an adequate pronunciation for his last name, but I think it's Elijah Surratt, the all Sun Belt wide receiver who'd been in the portal from JMU, committed to Indiana last night. I want to say this and people not hear it as like, oh, he's predicting Indiana's going to win 10 games next year. To his credit, it's been pretty impressive, at least on paper, what Kurt Cignetti has been able to do, particularly in the portal since coming to Indiana, in rebuilding some key spots on his roster.
Well, I tweeted it out. I mean, they were down to 49 scholarship players at one point, projected scholarship players. They're now at over the limit, over 80, at 87. And it might be 88 or 89, depending on if some of these players have scholarships or not, some of these kind of fringe players. But and a lot of that's been the portal. They've signed a ton of players. You know, it wasn't like just convincing the guys that were going to leave to come back. I mean, most of those guys didn't come back. They really targeted the, you know, five guys they wanted back. And that was it. I mean, so this is all, you know, new faces on this roster. So just that in and of itself, you know, regardless of how the results look, I mean, they have enough players now to get through spring practice. So that's a good start. How it all shakes out, I don't know what it looks like. You know, I do think there is something to be said for that jump from the, you know, FBS to, you know, just the Power Five level or Power Four, however you want to say it. And that there is some adjustment. You know, I think a guy like Surratt's kind of an exception, you know, where you show that amount of talent and that amount of success, but I think there is an adjustment level. But they've obviously gone with players they were comfortable with in terms of knowing their game. You know, the Old Dominion guys, they had scouted a lot, seen them all on film sort of as they kind of went through the season. Obviously a lot of James Madison faces. The running back room, I can't really explain, going kind of for these very experienced guys that haven't done much. But yeah, I'm curious, what is your kind of take as kind of how they've built this thing so far in the last couple of weeks?
I think that one of the interesting things to me with all the JMU guys they've taken, and not every one of them is going to convert to the Power Four level, obviously. You know, I think that the linemen, they seem to really have a lot of confidence in. And you also would imagine the linemen, they probably got a bit of an outside perspective from Bob Bostad as well. So there's probably a kind of a layer of redundancy in those evaluations. I think there's some of these guys like Aiden Fisher or James Carpenter, where I don't know if they can make the jump or not, but if in a vacuum, you know, Indiana had made no coaching change and just went out and got these guys, you would have said, well, second team all Sun Belt, or look at all those tackles or tackles for loss. That's a promising player who was ready for the opportunity to step up and see if they can make it in the Big Ten as opposed to the Sun Belt. Obviously, Surratt is kind of even a level above that. I do think the one thing with the JMU transfers in particular is, you know, guys always have to settle into their room and, you know, into the chemistry of their locker room and all that kind of stuff. But it is interesting that you're going to bring with you, if you're Kurt Cignetti and his staff, some guys that can talk about their process and can sort of testify to, well, the reason we do it this way is because it leads to this. Or, you know, it almost kind of like bridges a bit of the divide between a new coach and his roster when you've got so many guys that clearly have a level of faith and trust in Cignetti and his staff and, you know, their individual position coaches to say, yeah, I'm going to follow them up the ladder. I'm sure to some extent these guys would be like, yeah, great, Big Ten football. That's even a step up from where we were. But the flip side is, like, they've done a lot of winning at James Madison, you know, and when you look at a guy like Surratt, I mean, he reported a Wisconsin offer. He reported a Kansas State offer. He reported a Purdue offer. South Carolina. So it wasn't like he didn't have other choices. Bringing in guys that can, you know, that can kind of, you know, be, you know, just offer testimony to what makes you successful, I think helps just sort of like span that gap that is inevitably going to exist between a new coach and a roster that he didn't entirely recruit, that doesn't know him as well, that is going to need to earn his trust and he's going to need to earn theirs. I think that helps. And then, like, you know, in the same breath, I mean, when that wave of transfers was announced after the JMU bowl game, you know, there was only like one guy in JMU's top like 8 or 9 tacklers that wasn't either going to the draft out of eligibility or coming to Indiana. Like, it's, you know, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, freshmen they thought might be promising. We're talking about guys that under these coaches, for the most part, did a lot of really good things for 2 seasons at James Madison. And so, again, you look at it and you say, well, you know, at least for this team right now, it probably makes a fair amount of sense.
Well, and Kurt Cignetti said production over everything, right? Production over potential. That's what he's kind of talked about, you know, how he evaluates. And so to take the guys that have done it over the guys that had the potential, even though the ones that he recruited sort of fit what he's trying to do. And we've talked about this before. His goal is to get to, I mean, he hasn't put a number on it, but I mean, we've said at least 6 wins. I mean, his goal is to, I guess, would be to keep his streak alive, to not have a losing season, you know, at a minimum.
And he'll probably look at it and say, like, 8 home games. Like, I'm not, you know, I mean, I know we've talked about Scott Dolson has said we're basically just going to try and buy our way to 3 wins in the non-conference every year. We need to give ourselves that platform, and I don't think that's a bad thing. But if you're a first-year head coach who's clearly got the designs you're talking about, the ambitions you're talking about, and then you look at that schedule and you say, well, I don't play Penn State, I don't play USC, and I've got 8 home games, like, I'm not going to get many schedules more kind than that in the Big Ten. Like, they're not going to come a heck of a lot easier than that in the conference. Why not attack it?
Yeah, and, you know, when you look at the roster, I mean, there's so many questions, obviously, how it all takes shape. But, I mean, you really feel like offensively what they've done, and based on their past and their success sort of scouting and breaking down talent, you can kind of sort of, you know, when you pencil in the lineup, with the receivers that they got, now with the offensive line, kind of got experience at every single position. And now we hadn't done a podcast since Mike Kadick came back, you know, 2 returning starters to work with Bob Bosted for a second year, in addition to landing all the transfers with experience. You can kind of see this offense taking shape. You know, you mentioned Surratt, pairing him with McCulley and EJ Williams, like, that's a legit receiving corps, and you can kind of see maybe where the strength of this team is going to be if the quarterback situation pans out, if Rourke's the guy that you kind of want him to be. Defensively, I still think they could be take some wild swings here. They don't look formidable on paper, as where I think the offense, you can kind of really see where they're headed in what direction.
Yeah, it still feels like they need front 7 help defensively. Yeah. Maybe not a ton, you know, depending on their confidence in a couple of those guys that came with them, Michael Kamara, James Carpenter, Aiden Fisher.
A guy like Andre Carter that they got last year would be like the sort of maybe the final piece that they need to kind of feel good about the defense or something like that.
I feel like there's still maybe a hole at linebacker too, but I think we're probably talking about a small handful of players, like 2 or 3 at this point. Yeah. And obviously, as you pointed out, they don't have much space. I mean, at this point, they're almost accounting for some, you know, inbound attrition as well. But,
well, there are guys, you know, just to mention, there are some guys that have played like 5 years that haven't announced what they're doing. So, I mean, they could have behind the scenes just decided not to play too. So, but yeah, there will be attrition.
Some,
but
there's some promising, like, I heard a ton of stuff about Tadarius Collins last year that, like, there's a lot more there than people. And it's really easy to say that when the team is 3-9 and you're just trying to sell, like, you know, a more promising future. But the cupboard's not completely bare at a couple of those spots. And as you, and I think you're right in pointing out too, like there's guys who could have moved on. There's guys who, you know, you don't tend to hear about guys that wind up needing to take like a medical hardship exemption until, you know, a spring practice or something like that when a coach talks about it. But it doesn't feel like there's much more major surgery needed, which is good because there's probably not much more major surgery to do. It's, you know, a lot of what's going to happen in the portal has already happened. Unless you're Ole Miss and Quinshon Judkins decides to give you a New Year's present. But I just think like it does feel like they could use like one or two more meaningful contributors in that front seven defensively. And if they did that, I'm never going to say, oh my God, they won the offseason. Like that's the dumbest, you know, phrase imaginable in sports, but it does feel like it would.
Hey,
you
they're
starting on December 1st or whatever. With a list of like needs that was considerable, and you would feel like most, if not all, of those had kind of been ticked, I guess.
Like I said, they're fielding a team for the spring with a legitimate competition at every position, basically, and only having convinced four players of like the 25 that entered the portal back. I mean, they've done some work to sort of get this roster back to a spot where. Talent-wise, you probably say they're in a better spot than they were a year ago, and the staff's only been in place for 4 or 5 weeks. So, I mean, you know, it all could fall apart because they could be bad, I suppose. But, I mean, just the what they've done, you know, Kurtz, obviously, you know, people, I guess, have Googled him, right? Like he said, that the guys that they recruited, they've bought into his vision in this early going, and he's, you know, because I don't, he's not recruiting like the bot. I mean, a lot of it's JMU, a lot of it's Sun Belt guys. But like you said, when the guys that have started, you know, Terry Jones was, I think he had started or played 40 games, started like 28 or something. Those guys are sought after, especially after you've gotten all Sun Belt mention, you know, like
that's what the portal is typically for. Like outside of like Dylan Gabriel's in the portal or, you know, like Quinshon Judkins is in the portal. Most people are looking for experience. That's why you go into the portal instead of high school.
Like he probably had plenty of suitors and could have had his choice of teams, you know, and so, you know, landing a guy like guys like that, like that last night, those safeties was a really big deal. You know, land a starting safety tandem like that ready made. I mean, that's, you know, Serato get the headlines and rightly so, because he's an impressive. His analytical numbers were just insane in terms of like catching, sure-handedness. But landing two starting safeties is important for a team that had none. I mean, they lost four of the five that had played 300 snaps last year.
He reminded me a little bit. I said this in a video last night of Cody Latimer, who obviously had a really good 3-year career in Indiana, then went on to the NFL and I think the XFL as well. But no, I mean it's. It all kind of leads up to something which I'm fascinated by, and it won't really matter for at least a few more weeks.
They're going to play zone too.
They're going to play 2-3 zone. They're going to revolutionize defense. I can't remember, and I don't see any reason why this is really going to like wane or abate, bar something unforeseen. I can't remember a spring practice that was more. Widely anticipated than this one, you know, than the one that will be upcoming because of it's going to, first of all, there's the natural sort of new coach bump, but then there's also like the sort of the new quarterbacks, the 4-star freshman is going to enroll early. The 6-year kid from Ohio, he'll be there. You've got a ton of intriguing transfers. There's going to be a lot of position battles and there's going to be a lot of stuff up in the air there. You know, there's going to be all the general sort of like, hey, how does like a staff manage momentum and energy when like they're on the field instead of just like on Twitter, essentially. And I'm not mocking them, to be clear. I think they've earned a lot of the good press they've gotten, but it's going to be the first time in a long time that like, especially, and I'm not trying to be flippant, but you know, if the basketball season continues to just kind of wax and wane a little bit, it's going to be the first time in a long time, like spring practice is going to have a real element of like juice and attention to it in Bloomington, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it'll be interesting. I'm kind of, you know, based on kind of what I've heard about Cignetti, I'm hopeful that they open it up and are not protective of everything and allow us some access to sort of see things to be able to report on that. But yeah, I mean, like you said, there's position battles up and down the roster. It's a new full new coaching staff. I mean, the quarterbacks obviously are going to get a lot of the attention, but you know, how this all fits together, I think there's going to be some real intrigue. And you know, Cignetti so far has been a quiet kind of all-star with in terms of providing quotable material. He will be in front of a mic more often in the spring. So,
There we go. We're going to be just, you know, grinding at spring practice and then booking flights for the NCAA tournament.
I thought you booked your flight. You I thought you're ready. You got this team up there, right?
You booked your flight to Vegas.
Las Vegas, next year's Las Vegas Bowl. I'm
You
ready.
know, because you're still too new here to understand that the goal is Nashville.
No, the
It's a
goal is
4-hour drive. No, the goal
Vegas
is
to
Nashville.
bust.
Vegas is always
Vegas
there.
to bust.
Indiana's
Vegas is always there.
been Indiana's been
Nashville's always
making eyes at the Music City
there.
Bowl for God knows how many years now.
Who played in the Vegas Bowl? Northwestern had all the fun. Did you see all that? I mean, just looked like they were having such a
That
good
game
time.
ended like 13-0 or something terrible.
It was like zero. They had no yards in the first quarter, either team or something like that. I was gonna text that
Utah?
too. I was like, look at how much fun they're having. And they had hit the
Was
tables
it Utah
hard.
that they played?
Yeah. But that
Yeah.
shows like they had so much fun in Vegas, the football game, they couldn't get ready for that. I mean, it's just too much.
I remember being in New Orleans for the NCAA tournament once and just seeing like John Wall was a freshman at Kentucky and he and Eric Bledsoe were just walking down Bourbon Street.
Yeah.
Like, I guess you can do this when you're playing a 16 seed. It's fine. So just to be clear, they were walking. They weren't engaging in any illicit activity. I want to be very clear. I'm not accusing anyone of anything, but we'll leave it there before we get ourselves into any more trouble. We'll be back next week. We promise we're going to get back to doing these. We won't use any more holidays as an excuse. You won't hear President's Day be the reason we didn't do Mind Your Banners for
I
that
don't
week.
do present. Well, and we should go back to where we used to celebrate it, like where it was like Lincoln Day, Lincoln's birthday, and you know, like where there was multiple President's Days in the
There were
past.
multiple President's Days. It was kind of confusing. And
We
there
had,
was.
and growing up in Chicago, we had Pulaski Day. Like, let's do that. We're not doing a podcast on Pulaski Day, that's for
No.
sure.
All right. Get out of here. Thank you all for listening. This has been Mind Your Banners for January 5th, 2024. For the Indianapolis Star, for the Bloomington Herald Times, for Mike Nislik, I'm Zach Osterman. We'll talk to you soon.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.